You're listening to the UMentor talk show, now available on the Umoja app and everywhere else as well, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify. So I'm your host, Imran Dharamsi, and on this talk show, we invite professionals and teenagers to take us through their journeys and give us advice. So remember, if you have any questions for the panelists, you can always leave them in the comments or on the Inspire platform, or you can email us at mentor@umojaoutreach.org. Before we get started, just wanted to talk about today's sponsor. Thanks to today's sponsor, Paisly. Paisly is a payment technology company specializing in small to medium businesses in the United States. They pride themselves on their customer service and their out-of-the-box payment acceptance solutions. So if you are interested, please visit them at paisly.com or contact them at 813-565-9999 today. And if you want your business to be featured in this spot on the UMentor Talk Show, please donate to our show. You know, that's the only way we fund it, through donations. So visit us at mojaoutreach.org/donate. Now, as I was saying, you can leave questions on the Inspire platform if you have them. And it's a question and answer platform for career advice in our Shia community, which you can access via the Umoja app. So now getting into today's guest, because we do have a lot to talk about. So today's guest is Dr. Iqbal Jaffer, who is a cardiac surgeon and assistant professor. He's a staff cardiac surgeon and the program director of the cardiac surgery residency program at McMaster University and Hamilton Health Sciences. He also runs a specialized clinic that manages people with artificial heart valves and blood clots. And he has a very interesting story. So we are very, very excited to have you. And thank you for your time, Dr. Jaffer.
That's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So first, I know I did a little bit of an introduction, but could you just tell us a bit more about yourself, just an introduction and how you got into medicine?
Sure. You know, it's in medicine, like my journey to medicine has been a bit convoluted and different and out of the box. But while I was in the community, I didn't actually ever have my own name. It was always just Haider Jaffer's son. So I've even had patients still come up to me and say, "Oh, are you Haider Jaffer's son?" Yeah, I am. So in the community, that's my reputation. But in terms of medicine, I started in life sciences at McMaster University. And one of my electives was religious studies. And I actually realized that I didn't really enjoy life sciences. And so I switched out of life sciences in my second year to do religious studies as a major. But I kept working in medicine. I did research for different people. And so I engaged in projects that way. I then kept all my electives in religious studies as science credits so that I could be ready for the MCAT. So I wrote the MCAT a couple of times. Then I went to medical school in Australia, where I spent 5 years. I did 4 years of medical school and then a year of internship. And then during that time, I worked to come back to Canada. And so I applied to residency in Canada and I matched to cardiac surgery at McMaster. During my residency, I also did a PhD in medical sciences. And then after finishing my residency, I started as a clinical fellow. And then after my clinical fellowship, during my clinical fellowship, I was hired on as a staff cardiac surgeon. And then only recently I was hired on as an assistant professor. And then even more recent than that, I was made the program director.
Okay. Wow. So much to cover.
That's a 22-year journey that's distilled into one minute.
Yeah. Less than 1 minute. So I want to actually maybe take it back a little bit. So you didn't like life sciences at university. No. Well, I thought you're a doctor. What do you mean?
So here's the interesting thing. Yeah. I think that life sciences, the way that it was taught, you know, lacked the ability to do critical thinking and you know, actual real science. It was a lot of didactic and
memory
sort of work. Yeah. I was never built for that. I'm still not built for that. I'm a very, I like to understand concepts. You know, even though I was terrible at calculus, I can understand the need for calculus and I can understand how to apply it, but I'm not good at it. So, but I can't do it, but I know what it's about. So, you know, the religious studies was the opportunity to think critically and to analyze and to reflect. And the interest in religious studies was really the same interest as I have in medicine, which is really to get to know people, right? And I think that people's religion is very personal to them. And, you know, even when we talk about more broadly spirituality and even, you know, new age concepts of religion or spirituality, you know, those sorts of things are a way to engage people and to see how people think and they reflect on the world. So that was kind of my interest in that.
So just, can you talk about then your process into like getting into med school and why did you choose to go all the way to Australia? Sure. You're in Canada, right? So it's
sure. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, you know, I tell everybody that it's not the easiest path to leave. Right. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
You know, if certainly I could have gotten in here and I applied twice. So let's be clear about that. I did try twice to get in here. You know, I didn't get in and whatever, those are myriad reasons why that happens. But the truth of the matter is that if you want something bad enough and you go after it, then you know that there's going to be sacrifices. So going to Australia was, you know, 15 time zones away, right? It was very far. It was more expensive. And I literally knew nobody there when I got there. And, you know, despite the fact that they speak English, I didn't understand a word that they said. And, you know, it was challenging, right? And I spent 6 months there thinking almost on a daily basis that I made the wrong decision. But, you know, you settle in and you know, you find a support network and you find your people and you get through. And truly that was kind of my journey there. You know, I still have friends that are there that I still talk to, that I connect with. But it's a far away place. You know, I didn't leave there because I didn't like it there. I liked it there. I left there because, you know, there were certain other important things. Family was here and community was here. And those were also important in my life. And so, you know, they weren't as easily accessible there. Although subsequently I have found that there is, you know, a fairly reasonable sized community where I was and, you know, I could have engaged them had I known about them at the time.
I see. Okay. Yeah. What kept you going? Like, why didn't you give up after the first time not getting in and then the second time not getting in and then the 6 months of adjusting in Australia? Like what I guess pushed you?
Stubbornness. Plain out stubbornness, you know. I mean, so you set this plan for yourself, and I'm very goal oriented in that way. I set for everything. I set 1, 3, 5 year goals on a constant basis, and I reflect on them at the end of the year. And truly, going there was part of a larger goal, and part of the larger goal was to become a physician. And at the time, I didn't know that I wanted to be a heart surgeon. That happened while I was there. But, you know, the drive to keep going is the stubbornness that I'm going to get what I want. And this is what I think that I want. And I'm just going to keep going until I get it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, so you mentioned you didn't know that you wanted to be a cardiac surgeon. How did that realization come about?
Yeah. So, the story or the version of this that I tell is that it was kind of a three-phased introduction for me. So
okay,
when I was a kid, when I was like a baby, my grandfather had bypass surgery, and then he had subsequent bypass surgery when I was, you know, 11 years old, 10 years old. And my grandfather had this very like aggressive scar that was on his chest because he makes these big hypertrophic keloid type scars. And so, We grew up in the same house with my grandparents around when we lived in Africa. And so, I used to play in my grandfather's bedroom. I'd say, "Papa, what's this?" And so he would tell me about his surgery, and he showed me his scar on his leg. And that's, so it was just more of a social interest. My papa had this when he was, when I was little. Then when I was in university, my father had bypass surgery. And so I was, a bit more mature at that point. And so I did a ton of reading about it at that time and kind of tried to understand what it was all about and ask a lot of, intelligent questions, hopefully. And then when I was in medical school, my second year, one of my second year clinical teachers was a cardiac surgeon. And right. He, God bless him, never got bored of my inane questions. He took me to his OR and he mentored me. He mentored me for 4 years. And really, I think that really solidified my genuine educational professional interest in the field, right? I was curious about the field because of my personal relationship with it, but I was never educationally or intellectually engaged in it until this guy came along. And for for all that, I have him to thank.
I see. Yeah, I mean, thank you for sharing that story. And then now we're in Australia, you're in medical school, and you're deciding to go back to Canada. You said why, but we were talking earlier and you said only two of the 20 Canadians in your class in Australia came back to Canada. So talk about, why only two of 20 and how did you go about it?
So the in my class, there were 20 Canadians out of 300 and something people. And including me, there was one other person that came back to Canada. Now, the one other person came back a year earlier, right after graduation. She didn't stick around for the internship year. I stuck around for the internship year and then and then applied to come back. The reason that the other 18 didn't come back is because they made a life for themselves. They found partners there. They found jobs there. They found a home there. And that was their life. And so they decided that this was going to be their place. For me, it was about community and family wanting to come back. I wanted to raise my kids near their grandparents. And like I said, Australia is so far away. Like, it's just not a place that you can come to easily. And so the process of coming back is a mountain. And so you climb the mountain step by step. And so you write, and the process has changed since I did it, but you write the exams that you need to write and you connect with the people that are in the field that you want to be in, and you try to engage them as much as possible, and you do electives and you do observerships and whatever else. And it's really just a lot of hustle. And you hope that doors open for you. And, alhamdulillah for me, doors opened. And so my wife also, had to go through the same process. We got married while I was in medical school there. And so she had to go through the same hoops. And so we did it together. Alhamdulillah, we both came back and worked through that process. But it was certainly challenging. And it is a thing that I do not recommend as the primary option. Like, certainly if you don't get in Canada and you want to do this, I just tell people, go in with eyes open. The road is long. The road is hard. The road is expensive. And that's just really the message that I try to give everybody who says, should I go? And they say, you did it. Yes, but that was a very different time, right? Saying that I did something, over a decade ago is like saying, I bought a house that was $250,000, in 1980, and now it's worth $3 million. Yeah, well, times have changed, right? They're harder.
So do you generally recommend people don't go then?
It's not that
they just consider it very carefully.
Yes. I tell people that financially, emotionally, practically, this is a very large hill to climb. And, like climbing a mountain, if you're going to climb a mountain, you just need to be extremely prepared, right? You don't climb Mount Everest, as your first kick at the can of climbing mountains, right? You really need to prepare well, because that is not a small endeavor. And so when people want to go overseas, you can look at the match statistics and say that 26% of people who go to Australia and like 33% of people who go to Ireland for medical school match to programs as IMGs in Canada. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's the numbers, right? Versus 98% of people who go to medical school in Canada. Right. And so, like, you know, if we're not talking about small things, and if you can imagine that if you're in the 66% from Ireland or the 75% from Australia, you know, you've got $250,000, $300,000 worth of debt associated with your name. Yeah. And you're unemployable or you're unemployed. What are you going to do? Right. It's just people have to be ready for these challenges and understand what their bailouts are, understand what their backup options are. And that's the only thing that I try to tell people is like, I'm not discouraging you from going. I'm just making sure that you go with eyes open.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. So then just out of curiosity, then what was like your backup option in case things,
I was going to stay there.
Something didn't work. You're going to say, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I was employed already, right? Again, at a different time. I had a job. I had to actually resign from my job when I got the job here. And you know, I could have been on the path to becoming a heart surgeon there. And for, again, some practical reasons, I chose not to stay there in terms of the training environment there. But I could have done it. I was well connected to the community there. I was, people knew me. Like, I had been doing research there. I had presented at conferences. So my name was known and I could have got in, but it would have taken time. And so, but I just chose not to.
And you also, I think one thing you've been mentioning here is knowing people and having people know you. Talk, maybe you talk a little more about the importance of that.
You know, that's the importance of putting yourself out there is kind of like the mantra, right? it is the lack of fear of being looked at as being stupid or of not knowing or, you know, not being the smartest person in the room. I'm happy not to be the smartest person in the room. I'm happy to be the person that says what everybody's thinking that nobody wants to say because they're shy. And, you know, those sorts of things, for better or worse, are part of my personality. And they just lead to a lack of fear in terms of putting myself out there. And so if people want to do unconventional things, like go from religious studies to being a heart surgeon, then, you know, you gotta have a little bit of lack of fear for these putting yourself out there sort of opportunities.
So it's more put yourself out there, not, you know, and that comes from lack of fear, not necessarily like you have to know every single person.
The only way you get to know people, right, is you meet them at a conference, you're standing at the table and you say, hi, my name is Iqbal. It's very hard for people to be, okay, one step back. People come to my operating room, medical students, and I'm really fairly benign. Like I don't think I'm an intimidating character, but my position is intimidating to people, right? So, this is the staff surgeon. You know, people talk very softly and you guys can chill out, man. Like I'm not that guy. Like whatever you think I am, I'm not that guy, right? And you know, I don't need all this like Dr. Jaffer kiss the ring sort of stuff. I don't need any of that, right? Like I'm not about that at all, right? And so, but people have these perceptions that, you know, oh, he's a surgeon and he doesn't want to talk to minions like me and this and that. And I don't have any of that stuff. I'm like, if I want to talk to somebody, I just walk up to them at a conference, at a meeting, whatever. I shoot them an email. It doesn't, like these things do, what's the worst that's going to happen? They don't respond.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Yeah, and, yeah.
You know, who are you, kid? Go away. Right? Fine. Okay. Go away. No problem. Right? But until you try, these things don't happen for you. Right? Yeah. I went to an appointment with a cardiologist for myself. Okay. And at the end of the appointment, I said, hey, buddy, I want to do research in this field. Have you got any research going? And he goes, are you seriously asking me for a job at your consultation? And I said, yeah, I am. I said, you don't have to pay me anything, but I want to do research in this field. And he said, I don't, but I do know a guy. And so he gave me the name of that guy. And I contacted that guy and I said, hey, by the way, this guy gave me your name. Have you got any research? And so he calls me for a meeting. I worked for that guy for 4 years. He's a friend of mine still, 11 years down the line. He was a mentor to me. He was a friend to me. He was my employer. I mean, again, like none of that happens if I don't just say to the guy at the consultation, hey, by the way, I want to do research in this field. Have you got anything? Right? So like it's the wings of the butterfly sort of thing, right? Like the flapping of the wings of the butterfly lead to a tornado later, right? Or a hurricane later. Like this doesn't happen without this, without this, without this. And so, I'm here because of certain things that I did, but they all start from, hey, by the way, is there an opportunity here for me? My name is this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. I think we were still at medical school, so now we're at residency, I think. So when you match, do you apply to one program, or was it just kind of a coincidence that you ended up matching to McMaster?
So the year that I got into cardiac surgery, 2011, cardiac surgery was an undersubscribed program. I think there were 10 spots across the country or 11 spots across the country. And I think there was only 5 applicants. That ratio has changed dramatically. There are still only 10 or 11 spots across the country, but now there are 20 applicants. So the ratios have drastically changed. So, you know, I contacted every program director by email. I didn't know any of these people. I wasn't getting elective time in Canada. And so, and I said, look, this is who I am. This is what I want to do. This is my CV. You know, would you engage a conversation? I got a few replies. And so anytime somebody replied, I would take the time. And so, you know, the program in Halifax invited me to come. So I went there and I met with them for a week. And then the program in McMaster invited me to come. So I went there and met with them for a couple of weeks. And so, you know, wherever the opportunity, the door opened even a little, I walked through it. And so McMaster had a spot in the first round. They didn't match. And so in the first round, if you're an IMG, you were ineligible to match. But in the second round, it's open in Ontario. And so I matched in the second round to cardiac surgery at McMaster University. And that's really how I got in.
Kind of a coincidence, a little bit.
Well, I mean,
not really. You planned it out.
You make your own coincidences, right? Like,
yeah.
I think it's Michael Jordan, or it's a famous golfer. It's like, the more I practice, the luckier I get, right? The more I hustle, the more opportunities open for me, sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense. Yeah. Why did you then decide to do a PhD during residency?
So it comes back to critical thinking. It comes back to being engaged, right? So I didn't sign up for science in undergrad because I didn't like science. I liked science. I love science. Mm-hmm. I love the idea of discovery. And during cardiac surgery, I wanted to answer questions through basic science, and I still had that love for science. So I told my mentors, you know, this is what I want to do. And they all told me I was stupid and crazy and whatever. But then one of my mentors actually introduced me to a basic scientist who's, you know, a very good researcher, and we connected, and he taught me all sorts of skills on how to answer questions, clinical questions, with basic science. And so, you know, he mentored me, and I spent 3.5 years in his lab. And I, my initial plan was to get a master's degree. But within 11 months of being there, I generated so much data. He said to me, like, you know, you just need to transition to the PhD program and do 2 more courses, and we'll get you a PhD out of this. So it was again, a lot of support and mentorship that got me through.
Right. So now this was in parallel to also being a medical resident, right?
This was kind of like putting a pause on my residency so that I could do this. So the cardiac surgery residency is 6 years. I started in July 2011. And then in July 2013, I started graduate school as a third-year resident. And then I was basically paused at third year for 4 years or 3.5 years. And then I restarted
Okay.
residency. So July 2013, 14, 15, 16. So January 2017, I restarted residency as a fourth year
I see.
resident then.
Okay. And so was that guy, the one you worked for 4 years, the one you found out about during your cardiology appointment, or is that something else?
No, that was that cardiology
Oh,
appointment, that was in Australia.
okay. Oh, okay. No, because he
Yeah.
said 4 years, so I was
No,
I was
no,
wondering.
no. Like
Okay.
between that appointment and this one, there's been a passage of around 6 years of time. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay, so you finished, so then 2019 you said you finished your residency.
Yes.
And then so what did you do after that?
So then I started in 2020, January 2020, as a clinical fellow in the transcatheter valve program. Now, the transcatheter valves are valves that we put in usually in the aortic position, in patients with severe aortic stenosis, that is done through a puncture in the groin, so it doesn't involve surgery. And it is the domain of surgeons and interventional cardiologists, but the training program had thus far only been for interventional cardiologists, which are the people that do stents. So if I can differentiate, interventional cardiologists do stents and angiograms, heart surgeons do bypass surgery. So we work together and we take care of the same patients, but through different approaches. And so, they were doing the training for interventional cardiologists who wanted to do a subspecialty in transcatheter valves. And we approached them, my mentors approached them and said, "Would you train a surgeon?" And they said, "We would love to train a surgeon if you've got the right surgeon for us to train." So I was the first surgeon that they trained in that specialty, and it has really blossomed our relationship. So we continue to work together, and they're my friends and they're my colleagues, and I really enjoy working with them, and we've built really good strong partnerships in terms of how we take care of patients with aortic valve disease in Hamilton. And we do, we go to conferences and we talk together about these things, and so it was a really, really a fruitful relationship that we fostered.
Okay. So we're almost out of time, but maybe in 2 minutes, if you could describe just your current day-to-day,
Yeah.
as it stands right now, just so people can get an idea.
Yeah, so my clinical practice is adult cardiac surgery and transcatheter valves. So I do about 50% open heart surgery, and I do 50% catheter valves. And I do clinical work in terms of seeing patients for both aspects of that. I also run the specialized clinic where if you have a problem with your prosthetic valve, your artificial valve, I usually help take care of those as well. So I manage the care of those patients. And then also I have this new job of being the program director, which means that I am in charge of the educational curriculum for the residency program in cardiac surgery. And so, all the organization of education and how to teach surgeons, that's kind of my domain now.
I see.
So I work, yeah, that's kind of how I do. And things go through the day. Like sometimes I'm doing this and sometimes I'm doing that, but it's kind of a dynamic mix of all those things. Like
I
today
see.
is a day of doing some education stuff and doing some meetings, and tomorrow I'm doing catheter valves, and on Tuesday I was doing surgery. So it's just a it's a mix of things that I do all the time.
Okay. Do you enjoy it?
I love my job.
Okay,
I love my
cool.
job. There are hard days. There are long days. There are days that hurt your heart, hurt your soul, because of bad things happen. But on balance, we do a lot of good for a lot of people, and we do a lot of dramatic things. And for the most part, we're not saving lives. We're restoring quality of life. But sometimes when we do get opportunity to save lives, it's very gratifying work. And then, I have exactly what I wanted in my life in terms of my professional career. And so it took a long road to get here, but I'm very happy with where it's at.
Okay, great. Okay, so thank you for coming on the show. Just one last question, which I had promised you at the beginning. What is your final piece of advice? If people take away one main thing from listening to the show, what should it be?
Don't be afraid. Put yourself out there and just ask. Just ask. The fear is what holds people back. Fear of being ridiculed, fear of being perceived as stupid. Mm-hmm. Those things are all in your own head. Just you don't ask, you don't get. So don't be afraid. Just put yourself out there and take opportunities as they come.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Jaffer, for the time and for the interview.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me. And I'm honored at the opportunity to speak to you.
Of course. Thanks to all our viewers for tuning in to this talk show. You can tune in a couple of weeks, maybe 2 weeks, for another interview. And remember, you can always catch our previous episodes everywhere: YouTube, SoundCloud, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, everywhere. Umoja Outreach Foundation, uniting and empowering the Shia community.